This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We've got something very special today, an onstage interview that I recorded with NBC's late night host Seth Meyers in Verizon Hall on the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts Cultural Campus in Philadelphia. The event was part of the celebration of Fresh Air's 30th anniversary as a daily national program. So, let's go to Verizon Hall.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank all of you for coming this evening. You know, it's sometimes hard to sleep at night, and the political chaos isn't making it any easier. The old joke about late night comedy shows is that they put you to sleep. The way I see it, late night comedy, like Seth Meyers' show, makes it safe to sleep by helping us laugh at the issues that otherwise would be keeping us awake. Was I a little annoyed when he started to cross over into my territory and do interviews? Nope. I like his interviews. I became his fan when he started co-anchoring Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live back in 2006. After Tina Fey started her series 30 Rock, and by leaving, she did him a big favor because he took over both her jobs. He became the head writer and co-anchor with Amy Poehler of Weekend Update. And of course, he returned the favor by later writing hilarious sketches for Tina Fey when she was playing Sarah Palin during the 2008 presidential campaign. So, to get started, let's watch Seth Meyers' opening monologue on Late Night from Monday of this week after returning from a week off. Here we go.
President Trump last week announced that he was pulling the country out of the Paris Climate Agreement. We're pulling out. So now our climate policy is the same as Mike Pence's birth control policy. (laughs) 100% effective. White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said today that President Trump will not block former FBI Director James Comey from testifying before Congress. That's a good call, because if you block the testimony of the FBI director you praised for investigating Hillary Clinton and then fired for investigating your ties to Russia and then lied about why you fired him and later admitted why you fired him, you might look guilty. White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said today that President Trump doesn't care what you call his proposed travel ban. Okay, racist.
Please welcome Seth Meyers.
Thank you, everybody.
It's so great to have you here. Thank you for
doing
this.
I am so honored to be here.
Oh, it's so great to have you. So, you thought probably when you were leaving Saturday Night Live and Weekend Update that you'd be taking a step away from political comedy, and you did for a bit.
Yeah.
And now you're deep back in.
Yeah.
With your opening monologue and then a closer look in which you focus on a political subject, and it's usually Trump.
It has been Trump for a while now, yes.
So comedy is going places that it's political comedy is going places it's never gone before. I don't know if you've made jokes about Ivanka and Donald Trump, but people have been making kind of incest jokes.
Sure.
And then you've done jokes about him being cold to Melania and not caring about his son, Eric. And you gave him the finger on TV the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the fake press conference where you were asking the questions and you cut in his answers, and all of your questions were about his penis, because when he talked about his hands, that seemed to open the door to his penis. Yes, so it...
I'm so happy how quickly we have gotten to this, Terry.
I did not want to waste any time.
Everybody said, you know, Terry in person's a lot saucier.
So late night comedy has changed. There's like an unprecedented president open up the door to unprecedented comedy.
Sure. Well, when the standard of what a president says drops so low, it seems
when
silly.
He goes low, you go low.
Right. Exactly. And I, you know, I always want to stress this because I think a lot of us that do shows like we do, that I do, my many colleagues who are really good at this too, people say, oh, you're doing the job of journalists. I think it's very important to note that we can't do our job without journalists. Journalists can do their job without late night comedians. They'd be just fine without us.
But we, of course, use their work every day to build our pieces. But I do think that comedians have this advantage that journalists don't have right now because, thankfully, and I think we're all lucky as a society that journalists are trying to hold this standard and hold this line of what it means to be a journalist and the integrity that it means to be a journalist, whereas comedians are built for the Donald Trump era because we comedians notoriously have very low levels of integrity.
Now, Stephen Colbert recently got a lot of negative tweets and viral negativo social media and a lot of FCC complaints because here's the setup. Trump was on Face the Nation with John Dickerson, and he called it Disgrace the Nation. And so Stephen Colbert said, when you insult one person from the CBS family, you insult all of us. And he basically did this, like, you want to hear what an insult really sounds like? And he just, like, let loose with these actually very funny insults. But one of them was kind of obscene, and some people interpreted it as being homophobic because of an oral sex reference.
Yep.
Did that have a chilling effect on you? Not that, I mean, you...
Well, first of all, I do want to point out the president calling Face the Nation, Disgrace the Nation is pretty funny. At the National Prayer Breakfast, where he started by saying we should all pray for Arnold Schwarzenegger's failing ratings. Because what is prayer if not a time to air petty grievances? But that was funny. And I do think there are times where he's trying to be funny, where somebody tries to write a joke on it, and we point out, well, in his defense, he was making... There's plenty to make fun of what he says, that he's trying to be serious, and it comes out comic. But I think comedians, you know, that there are times where we risk being edgy, and I think that's very important, but you ultimately, your audience will decide what is okay and what is not okay.
Okay, so since we've been talking a little bit about humor about Donald Trump, I think it's only fair that we watch the 2004 sketch that you did with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
In 2004, Donald Trump was the guest host, and there was a sketch called Fathers and Sons, and as you'll see, Donald Trump was the father, Seth Meyers was the son.
This is so eerie and weird that this is a thing.
Okay, let's roll the tape.
Hi, welcome to Fathers and Sons, the show that teaches and discusses how positive communication between fathers and sons can make this special relationship between two men even better. I'm Peter Fleck, and this is my dad, Gary. There's no reason why sensitivity and warmth can't be key ingredients between fathers and sons. That's why we're here today on Fathers and Sons. Isn't that right, Dad?
You could really cut that intro in half. Boy, it's way, way too long.
Okay, here we go again. All right. It's a bit long, you're right.
You don't have to tell me when I'm right. I know when I'm right. Now, let's do it. Come on. This is just a miserable way to spend a Sunday.
Our first segment is called Father and Son Memories. We've each prepared a story. My story takes place at a Little League game when I was 13. A ground ball went through my legs, and Dad screamed, "Hey, fellas, anyone want to lend me their son for the day so I have something to cheer about?" Do you remember that, Dad?
I don't remember you ever playing baseball.
I played for 8 years.
Well, I remember you were on a team. I just don't remember you playing baseball. Ha, ha, ha.
Surprising I wasn't a better player. I mean, we practiced once, but then you left because you were worried my sissy was contagious.
Yeah. All right, I forgot. Everything's my fault, isn't it? Maybe I should blame my dad for not being a better parent, or blame his dad. Or go back to blame the caveman for not playing enough dinosaur ball with his kid. Or plan B, be responsible for yourself.
The scary thing is it's basically a campaign platform.
So I only regret that our radio listeners won't get to see you wearing the Donald Trump
the
wig.
The Donald Trump wig, yeah.
Because for our radio listeners, I want to say that Seth Meyers was wearing a Donald Trump wig to look more like Donald Trump's son.
Yeah.
What was the occasion for him hosting then?
He used to be a very popular reality television host. A lot of people don't remember that.
So who wrote that sketch, and why was it a father and son sketch? And I'm thinking of all the jokes you've made about his relationship or his lack of relationship, seemingly, with Eric. So why was this a father-son sketch?
Well, I clocked pretty fast that that was the kind of guy he was. And, you know, you spend a couple days at SNL, or a day and a half, basically, before you have to start writing things. And I always found it was helpful to just sort of pay attention to the host and think, what could they believably do? Especially when they're not actors. And I thought, well, I bet he could play a father who was pretty not into his kid. And it wasn't bad. I will say, the other thing we did with him, which I have even fonder memories for, we did a sketch called Donald Trump's House of Wings, where he had his own hot wing store. And we sang, the theme song was to Jump by the Pointer Sisters. And it was, Trump, you know his wings, we'll fill you up. Trump, you know these wings, we'll make you happy. If you want blue cheese, it'll be a dollar extra. Donald Trump's House of Wings. And he, thank you. He thought, and myself, Keenan, Maya, and Amy Poehler were all dressed as chicks in eggshells. And he was in a white suit with a yellow shirt and tie. And he always thought it was the dumbest sketch. And he never got why it was funny. And the audience went crazy for it. And you watch, and it now, it's the same way when he was giving speeches. Sometimes things would just work, and you'd watch him realize it worked. Stuff like, I'm going to build a wall, and people would go crazy, and then it worked. And that was his reaction to that. It started working, and he was like, well, okay, I'll do this now. And the other thing about that week that I remember was, and this is true, I'm not making this up, he carried around, he had cut out the ratings, the Nielsen ratings for that week. And he had them in his pocket. And I remember he would basically ask everybody a couple questions and then just show it to them. Like, for example, I remember sitting there rehearsing that. He would say, do you like this job? And I said, yeah, I do. And he goes, how long have you been here? I said, 3 years. And he said, did you see the ratings? That is a real thing.
Okay, let's talk about you. How did you get deep into comedy, and how did you get the confidence that you could actually go on stage and tell jokes?
My father, to this day, is the funniest person I know, and he was the funniest person anybody who knew him knew. And when I could make him laugh, I had this sense of, I might be good at this. And also my parents, at a very inappropriate age, introduced us to things like SNL and Monty Python, and it was stuff that I just loved and was delighted by. And I went off to college, and I hadn't really done much comedy stuff, but I went to Northwestern University, and there was a really good, there's some Wildcats in the house, and they had a really good improv troupe, and I saw it New Student Week of my freshman year, and I had a real sense of, I don't know if I could do stand-up, that seems really terrifying, but I think I could get up on stage with other really funny people and come up with things off the top of my head.
So your mother once said, and this is online, that you cut school a lot in high school.
Yeah.
What were you doing when you were cutting school?
All right, by the way, what my mom is leaving out of that quote,
yes,
is she was so complicit in this. My mom, who was a school teacher, would also cut school. I cannot tell you, again, I have an equally fantastic relationship with my mom. I would say, I got a sore throat. And she would say, oh, should we call it a day? And then,
seriously?
Yeah. And we'd have to wait. We'd have to wait for my dad to leave because my dad was not in on that. I would say I have a sore throat. He would say, go downstairs and have a piece of toast and some tea. Then you'll feel better. And it was, I wanted to say, look, here's how this is gonna go. I'm gonna come down, we're gonna do the whole toast tea thing. You're gonna leave and I'm gonna come right back to bed. So ideally, I wouldn't get up now. But I mean, that was my, so much of my childhood when I cut school was, and I am, you know, my mom would go to the video store and, you know, rent movies, and we would just hang out all day and watch movies.
Now, a lot of people in comedy are driven by demons of one sort or another. They're depressed, nearly suicidal, or they have a lot of rage, or resentment, or neurosis, jealousy. I could go on.
Yeah.
And that's a fortunate thing, because we all have some of that, and they can get us to laugh at our own demons. You don't seem to be that guy. You don't seem to be doing comedy because you're driven by, like, anger or rage or despair or depression.
No, I'm not. You know, by the way, I think my wife would point out, he's more of a bummer than you think he is, but she would also agree with that thesis. I got into it because it looked like the most fun job in the world. I really did. And it has not led me astray. It was a chance to work with people who were really funny, which has been the greatest gift of this life. And I loved sports and was terrible at sports. And I never once in my life did anything on any field of play that gave me that adrenaline rush of success. But I do feel that, you know, when you write something or when you tell a joke that works really well, it's the greatest feeling on earth.
Some people who are obsessive, as I imagine you must be about comedy, yeah, have to be kind of obsessive to get to where you are. And some people who are obsessive kind of channel it outwards on an outward passion. Some people who are obsessive channel it inwards and obsess on themselves and on the things that they are insecure about or that they hate about themselves. Do you have obsessions, and have you been able to channel them mostly outward?
I've tried very hard, and I think I'm really lucky, particularly with this show. I have all this real estate to fill it out every week. And so I try to just follow my own instincts as opposed to really drill down on things that I think are wrong about it. You know, we made this decision after our show every night not to do like sort of a post-op where
really?
We took the position instead, sleep on it, and if it's still bothering you in the morning, let's talk then. And then the reality is you then are just focused on the next show. And so it's nice to be in this place where you can be very forward-focused and constantly moving, as opposed to, and it happened at SNL. You know, when you had a bad SNL, it stayed with you all week, particularly if it was before a hiatus week. It just drove you crazy. As a writer, I am probably a little bit more obsessive than as a performer. And like, if I write something, if I have a joke in a closer look and it bombs, I feel like it ruins the rest of my show because I blame myself. Whereas if another writer wrote it, I don't blame them. Yeah, I just fire them and then move on. Never have to see them again, it's the best. Because I don't do it, I have someone else do it. I would never, yeah. I don't like seeing other people be sad either, so.
Your life has changed so much. You've gone from Saturday Night Live to hosting a daily show. And you had your baby about 14 months ago, you and your wife?
Yeah, little boy.
So like you're a father and a relatively new host. It's been, what, 3 years?
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
And you're what, 42 now?
43.
You're 43. So you were about 42 when your son was born.
Yeah.
Did you expect to be a father?
I did. I always thought I'd be a father, and then I was just way too interested in busy with what I was doing for a living, and I hadn't found the right person to have him with. And so, I did.
Okay, this sounds like a strange question. Why did you want to be a father? Because not everybody does.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I really don't. And the weirdest thing about being a father is how, because I think, you know, mothers, like, their body for 9 months tells them it's coming. And then you aren't a dad, and then you just are.
Right.
Like the very next day. this is a true story. I was filling out paperwork after our baby was born, and it said mother's name, and I wrote my wife's name, and then it said father's name, and I wrote my wife's father's name. And then it said father's phone number, and I thought, who knows their father-in-law's phone number? And then I realized, oh, I'm the father.
Okay, so one more question. You have to have a lot of adrenaline every night to do the show. And adrenaline's great when you need it, but it's bad as a chronic thing for your body. You know, bodies don't like to have constant adrenaline.
Yeah.
Lots of side effects of that. So what do you do?
I had no idea. This is heartbreaking to me. Yeah. So I'm sorry to end with this, but you are slowly dying.
That was my point.
Yeah.
No, so what do you do to kind of calm yourself down after getting, you know, worked up, like, you know, like just getting so into it for the show?
You know, I basically...
Drugs, I know, right.
Just
there's
a little,
lots
yeah.
Lots of drugs.
Yeah. Handful of pills.
Handful of
and,
pills.
And, no, I mean, you know, it's nice. I get home about 8:30. I get to have dinner with my wife. You know, we've been together, we were together through SNL as well. And at SNL, we never saw each other. And this is so much nicer, and just to spend time with her is the perfect. I love it. I'm like, nothing kills adrenaline like a night with my wife. I mean, tell you, it just leaves the body.
Okay, well.
I love you, darling.
I want to thank you, Seth Meyers. I think you are so great. And I really enjoy your show. It's been wonderful to watch you over the years. You know, all the changes you've gone through. I feel like I've been there in front of my TV, seeing it. And you're so wonderful in person. Thank you so much. It's just been such an honor to have you.
Thank you.
Doing this event with us.
And may I say, thank you all very much. So kind. There were three moments in my career where I thought I had made it. The first time I did David Letterman, the first time I was an answer in a New York Times crossword puzzle, and the first time I did Fresh Air. And to do it with you live and in person is such a great honor. Every night when I interview people, I am thinking, I wish I could be as good at this as Terry Gross. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. God, thank you, sir.
Really appreciate it.
Seth Meyers is the host of NBC's Late Night. We're so grateful that he was willing to come to Philadelphia for this event and help us celebrate our 30th anniversary as a daily national program. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg says, if you ask writers and editors what's the most annoying feature of online communication, they'll likely tell you it's the abuse of the exclamation point. But Jeff says, people have been complaining about the overuse of the exclamation point since Victorian times. In Jeff's opinion, the mark gets a bad rap.
The only literary work about punctuation I'm aware of is an odd early story by Chekhov called The Exclamation Mark. After getting into an argument with a colleague about punctuation, a school inspector named Yefim Perikladin asks his wife what an exclamation point is for. She tells him it signifies delight, indignation, joy, and rage. He realizes that in 40 years of writing official reports, he's never had the need to express any of those emotions. As he obsesses about the mark, it becomes an apparition that haunts his waking life, mocking him as an unfeeling machine. In desperation, he signs his name in a visitor's book and puts 3 exclamation points after it. All of a sudden, Chekhov writes, he felt delight and indignation. He was joyful and seethed with rage. Yefim Perikladin, c'est moi. At least, I used to be one of those people who use the exclamation point as sparingly as possible. We'll grudgingly stick one in after an interjection or a sentence like, what a jerk, but never to punch up an ordinary sentence in an essay or email. We say we're saving them for special occasions, but they never seem to arise. The written language provides us with a dozen or so punctuation marks to clarify our meaning, but only one that conveys our feelings about what we're saying. Yet the exclamation point gets no love at all. Apple Computer forbids its distributors to put it in their ads. The British school curriculum penalizes students for using it. There's a blog called Excessive Exclamation that documents its misuse. It wasn't always so disreputable. Melville and Hawthorne used it freely. But by the late 19th century, it had become the staple of lurid novels and the sensational yellow press, whose printers called it a screamer, a shriek, or a bang. Ever since then, self-respecting authors have regarded the wanton use of exclamation points as illiterate and slightly vulgar. F. Scott Fitzgerald said that it was like laughing at your own joke. The mark was banished to the literary margins. Manual typewriters didn't even give it a key of its own. You had to type a period, then backspace, then type an apostrophe, by which time any spontaneous excitement would have fizzled away. It lived most of its life on the pulp paper of Nancy Drew mysteries and Superman comics. Tom Wolfe and Roy Lichtenstein made it the emblem of pop culture kitsch. Pow, wham, vroom. To be sure, most people pay no attention to the qualms of editors and grammarians. They've always used exclamation points freely in their letters and diaries. Nobody found that alarming until the marks began to surface in emails and texts. Critics suddenly discerned a plague in exclamation point addiction that copy editors called bangoria. The impression's understandable. Exclamation points have become so obligatory in email that it can sound brusque to merely write, "See you then," period. People scatter them with abandon in text and tweets to convey friendliness, surprise, or indignation. Others use them for pure emphasis. They write their message in all caps, then hold down the exclamation point key to string them out to the end of the line like a row of air horns. Of course, the more the bangs pile up, the more numbing they become. But the moral panic may be overdone. We're not talking about the New York Times, after all. Texts and tweets are just an extension of spoken language. We punctuate them to capture the way we talk, and we aren't always going to use our indoor voices. I think of the Seinfeld episode where Elaine and her boyfriend broke up after he took down a phone message that her friend Myra had had a baby without putting an exclamation point at the end.
Well, see right here, you wrote Myra had the baby, but you didn't use an exclamation point.
So?
So, it's nothing. Forget it. You know, I just found it curious.
Wait, what's so curious about it?
Well, I mean, if one of your close friends had a baby and I left you a message about it, I would use an exclamation point.
Well, maybe I don't use my exclamation points as haphazardly as you do.
You don't think that someone having a baby warrants an exclamation point?
Hey, look, I just jotted down the message. I didn't know that I was required to capture the mood of each caller.
Look, I just thought that you'd be a little more excited about a friend of mine having a baby.
Okay, I'm excited. I just don't happen to like exclamation points.
Well, you know, Jake, you should learn to use them. Like the way I'm talking right now, I would put exclamation points at the ends of all of these sentences. On this one and on that one.
Well, you can put one on this one. I'm leaving!
You could think of that exchange as a skirmish in an orthographic gender war. Exclamation points have always been seen as expressions of girlish gushiness, and Jake's aversion to them suggests a certain horror of emotional display. As it happens, the research shows that women do use them more than men in online communication, chiefly to signal friendliness. That might suggest that some people aren't using them enough. Yet writers and editors only pride themselves on expunging the marks, never on sticking them in. When it comes to exclamation points, the only virtue we recognize is self-restraint. Look at the lengths people go to find workarounds to avoid them. Some suggest replacing them with more descriptive language. Instead of saying, "See you there," with an exclamation point, you can write, "I'm so looking forward to seeing you," period, at the expense of replacing one skinny character with a couple of dozen fat ones. Others suggest that rather than effusing over some bit of news, you can add an animated GIF of Shirley Temple clapping her hands and let her do it for you. Or you can separate your words with what I think of as power periods, as in best period, party period ever, each one a little puff of certitude. But at that point, avoiding an exclamation point becomes more of a fetish than using one. I dropped my reservations a while ago. Now I use the marks as abundantly as I did when I was 12. Like Chekhov's Periclodon, I didn't come to appreciate them till later in life. But I figure I might as well go out with a bang.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Today we have an interview with Joe Biden. Biden was elected senator from Delaware in 1972 when he was 29. During his 36 years in the Senate, he chaired the Judiciary and Foreign Relations Committees. In his two terms as vice president, he worked closely with President Obama on foreign policy and national security issues. He negotiated budget deals and headed the initiative for gun safety legislation after the shootings at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. He's out of office now, but still active in politics and diplomacy. I spoke with Joe Biden Tuesday evening at WHYY, where he was the recipient of the WHYY Lifelong Learning Award for his distinguished career in public service and commitment to education. Here's an excerpt of our interview.
So President Obama was the first African-American president, the only African-American president. Do you think racism figured into your ability to move your agenda forward? And what was the effect of racism on the White House when you were there?
First of all, Barack Obama's most self-aware man or woman I've ever met in my life. He has a full, complete understanding of who he is, what he is, and the realities he faces. And so I used to get very upset sometimes when the body language of people in the Oval would be disrespectful. And I remember one day going out after a congressman, Barack grabbing me and pulling me back and saying, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to teach that guy some lessons." It was incredibly disrespectful. And he looked at me and he said, "Joe, you take the good with the bad, man." He said, "Do you think I would have beaten you in the 2008 if I had been a 43-year-old white boy?" But the fact is, there is racism. It does exist. He was the brunt of it many times. But because of his caliber, because of his integrity, because of his humanity, he was able to rise above the what I would have found difficult to dismiss and go on and get a lot of business done.
I would really love to know, if you care to share it, what you were thinking when you watched Donald Trump take the oath of office.
No, I can tell you what I was thinking. I was hoping, and I mean this sincerely, I was hoping that he'd rise to the office. And let me explain what I mean by that. In fairness, I don't think Donald Trump ever expected to win, number one. Number two, he's the only administration that won or lost that I'm aware of since 1972 that during the campaign did not have a transition team in place. And so I was hoping he would know what he didn't know and not let the bravado get in the way of acknowledging what he didn't know and reaching out to really talented people to fill the void for him. I was hoping he would step up in a way, and I still hope that will happen as reality sinks in. I mean, here's a man who said he was surprised, and I believe him, he was genuinely surprised that being president was as difficult as running a real estate empire. I just, but
for
but,
our
by
radio
the way,
audience, can I just say that you just crossed yourself?
No, but look, this is, we're one country. I give you my word as a Biden. I've been rooting for his success. It's desperately in all of our interest to do that. And if you notice, Barack and I have not gone after him personally. We've not gone into that mosh pit. We have taken issue with him when we think he's wrong, which is, to be very blunt about it, most of the time. No, but here's the thing. He is not ideological, in my view. So Barack and I have talked about it. The hope was that he would be able to find some common ground. He would reach out. But it seems as though his leadership style has gotten in the way of what intellectually I don't think he has a problem with.
So if you're willing to answer this, there are current investigations into President Trump's ethics, his business practices, his campaign's communications with Russia. What are your biggest concerns now about the Trump presidency and the issues that are being investigated?
I am going to say something outrageous. I think I'm as informed on foreign policy as anybody in America. And that's an awful thing to say. I'm not running for anything, so I can say it. And I've been doing this for 44 years of my life. I've spent as much time as anyone in public life trying to learn the detail. And I think I've known every major world leader in the last 37 years, and I've known them by their first names. And one of the things that concerns me is that I know, let me say it again, I know Russia is deeply involved and was deeply involved, not just in trying to alter our electoral process and undermine our democracy, but all of Europe. If I could give you the classified information, I don't even have to go there. Look what they attempt to do in France, what they're doing now in Germany, what they did in Moldova, what they have done in the Balkans, what they have done throughout Europe. It is a conscious, means to undermine the institutional structures of each of those countries. Now, this is not hyperbole. This is a fact. Look, Putin has one overarching objective, not to reestablish the empire, but to break down the post-World War II liberal order that erected institutions to prevent the abuse of power, from the physical abuse by setting up NATO, to Bretton Woods, to the United Nations, to domestically here at home. And so what this is all about, it's about making sure that there is no unity in Western Europe, allowing us to have the kind of leeway we have to influence the rest of the world. And when that occurs, there's only medium-sized powers that, in fact, Russia has to worry about, which fundamentally alters their ability to use corruption as a tool to undermine Eastern and Central Europe. That's what this is about. These guys are for real. I am desperately worried that we are not going to, this administration will not, and maybe even try to prevent finding out the truth about the depth and the breadth of the Russian attempts to undermine our electoral process. And the other relates to what I find it hard to believe, how the Republican Party cannot be apoplectic about the impact of Putin in particular and Russia generally in trying to fundamentally alter our democratic processes. It's real, and it's not going to stop. Mark my words. It is not going to stop until we respond as swiftly and as directly as Barack did when it became clear to 17 agencies what was being done. And so it just really baffles me. I just wonder whether they're going to gain the willingness to stand up and say, enough, man, enough.
So you and President Obama, it's my understanding that you knew during the campaign that Russia was trying to interfere in the election and that you and the president decided not to say anything to the public about it. What I've read, and you can tell me if this is accurate or not, is that there were a couple of reasons for it. One is that you didn't want to give the appearance of interfering in the election in a way that would support Hillary. And the other was you didn't want to do Russia's work for Russia, since Russia's goal was to create chaos and have Americans lose faith in the electoral process. Do you have any regrets about not having said something at the time?
No.
How come?
The people who had to know were informed. There was no direct evidence that we could find of them actually able to manipulate the actual machines and or voter rolls. In this environment, and I think President was right, in this environment, we would have been accused of being engaged in trying to manipulate the election by using information that was not self-evident to the public, would require the release of classified information to prove. It would have been, I think, far worse.
Can you explain something to me about Twitter? I always thought that like presidents and vice presidents operate in this like world of like super secure communications. And we know now that President Trump tweets alone in the middle of the night and says, you know, a lot of things of consequence and some things that aren't coherent. So, like, what are the rules? Did you have social media when you were vice president? And, like, what rules were you expected to follow?
I'm not that old, yes. I had social media.
How did they take that stuff away from you?
I have social media, had it, and we have millions of people following us. But there's a difference between using the modern media and the means of communication than there is being irresponsible or irrational in the way you do it and just venting. You know, words matter. When the presidents speak, the world listens. And look, the idea that somebody, no matter what they do, no matter what their profession or their interest is, that gets up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and tweets vitriol, what it does, it fundamentally alters the view of the character of the presidency in the rest of the world. You know what I heard Well, I was just in Greece and in Italy and leading with a lot of national figures in each of those countries. You know the one thing that's done the most damage? When the President of the United States stiff-armed and moved. No, I mean it. I'm not joking. And then stood like this. That was the image of America, almost the image of the ugly American, that it has such resonance. And I don't understand why the president doesn't understand that it matters.
I want to ask a few questions about you and your life. You've been touched by death several times, beginning when you, just before you were took the oath of office as senator, your wife died, your baby daughter died, your two sons were hospitalized because of a car accident. Your son Beau died not long ago. You were read last rites when you had your aneurysm. Thank God you survived. The Senate is a place where it's real hardball. I mean, collegial or not, it's about politics, it's about hardball, it's about power to get your agenda passed and so on. A lot of people are there because they like power, because they really value power and want to have it. So coming from this place where you've been exposed to mortality and to like the ultimate meaning of life, what was it like to be in the Senate where it's not a place where I'd imagine it's easy to express vulnerability, where you have long reflective conversations about the meaning of life and that kind of thing? Was it ever hard to hold on to the principles of what you had to do as Senate or what happens in the Senate and those like deep feelings that you surely were carrying with you at all times?
No, it was never hard. And the Senate wasn't like that. A lot of my colleagues, Republican colleagues, Democrats, saved my sanity. They were incredibly empathetic. I never once was in a situation where, well, that's not true, once, a senator from Texas, but never once was I in a situation where there wasn't some degree of sympathy or empathy. But it's because we used to know one another. We'd have lunch with one another. You know, it's awful hard when I learn that, God forbid, your mother has breast cancer, or you have a child who's a drug addict, or you have a serious deficiency in that you stuttered badly like I did, or whatever. It's hard to dislike you when I know the human frailty and the pain that you're suffering. You can disagree, but you don't then question motive. You actually embrace one another in times of difficulty. I'll give you one example. When I first got to the Senate, and one of the meanest guys I ever met was a senator from the state of Arkansas, McClellan. And he used to eat privately in the Senate dining room. And so my AA said, you got to go down and you got to meet some of these guys. I walked in. He was eating by himself, Senator McClellan. I was 30 years old. And I walked over and I said, hello, Senator. And he put his hand up and said, hey, he said, you're the kid just had your tractor trailer just killed your wife and daughter, right? And your kids are in tough shape. And I felt like reaching down and ripping his Adam's apple out. And I said, yeah. He said, you're mad at me, aren't you? And I said, I don't have any more to say, Mr. Chairman. He said, well, let me tell you. He said, when I was your age, I was riding home. They didn't used to pay to get our family home. And my wife and kids were in the Ozarks heading home. And she dropped dead. She had an aneurysm. And then he said, my son worked for Aramco in 1966. I was on a NATO trip. I got a call saying he got crushed in an oil rig and he died. And I was going to meet his body. I was going to meet the casket at the airport in Little Rock. And he said, I was there. And while I was waiting for the plane to unload, I heard a crash at the gate. My other son's motorcycle was killed on the way in. So he looked at me and he said, so son, work. Just work. Work. You don't know the pain other people have had. I'll bet I won't do it if I surveyed all of you. Every one of you have tremendous loss.
So this is a really personal question, and perhaps I shouldn't be asking it, but I think most people have not been read last rites and survived. You have. Did you think you were dying when they were read it to you? And what goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, look, My mother used to have an expression, for real. She said, as long as you're alive, you have an obligation to strive, and you're not dead till you've seen the face of God. And so they told me to say goodbye to my sons, and they came in. They were they were young men in high school. And, you know, I really wanted to meet the test I thought you should have to meet to be able to tell them what you expected of them and do it with dignity and move on. And, you know, they told me I had somewhere between a 30 and 40% chance of living. And I thought, for real, I thought, well, what the hell? That's 3 in 10. Why not me? It's going to, you know. I don't talk about it, and I'm not going to tonight, but I find great solace in my faith. I happen to be a Roman Catholic, a practicing Catholic. And in Washington, I don't know how many sophisticated, particularly liberal people over the last 40 years have come and said, are you really a practicing Catholic? Like, can you be that stupid? No, it's not a joke. And I always the same, and rather than when I was younger want to punch them, I would say, yeah, for two reasons, nuns and Jesuits. And we got a great one now, but at any rate. But I find great solace in my faith. I'm not all that spiritual, but I found that for me, the externalities of my faith bring me a sense of peace. And so, you know, when my son died, he had this set of rosaries on. And I've been wearing it since, and I will wear it till I die. And I find myself just having it. I'm not saying when I pray the rosary, God's going to help me. I'm not making that case. It's just solace.
I want to thank you for all of your service to our country. And I want to thank you for being here this evening, for honoring us with your presence.
Terry, I want to thank you
so very much.
Look, guys, I'm glad you're there, Terry, and I hope you keep going, kid, even though you're only 24. Thank you.
My interview with Joe Biden was recorded Tuesday evening at WHYY in front of an audience attending a dinner in which Biden received WHYY's Lifelong Learning Award. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.